well, and shining a much-needed light upon these unprecedented levels of secrecy and powerful world players, this new age of citizen media bravely contends that the Bilderberg Group's lobbying powers represent nothing less than a threat to the democratic process. Well, that's it, everyone, for this week. Bye-bye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa by a shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
Having lost the election as well as dozens of post-election challenges, Donald Trump's ongoing refusal to admit defeat is still doing damage to Joe Biden's transition to power. The formal process has finally begun, but it is weeks late and spent a long time starved of funds as Republican officials stonewalled usual procedures. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Richard Wolff. The piece is titled, How Trump is Destroying the Presidential Transition Process. Stay with us for more of Richard Wolff's article. Having lost the election as well as dozens of post-election challenges, Donald Trump's ongoing refusal to admit defeat is still doing damage to Joe Biden's transition to power. The formal process has finally begun, but it is weeks late and spent a long time starved of funds as Republican officials stonewalled usual procedures. But beyond the inconvenience and cost of a deferred start to his administration, what does the president-elect lose from the president's refusal to acknowledge the inevitable? The answer goes far beyond Donald Trump's hurt feelings or the desire among Biden supporters for some form of concession. Even the smoothest of transitions can be painfully slow for the world's largest economy. Presidential transitions are, at the best of times, impossibly unwieldy and inefficient. The federal government has more than 2 million full-time civil servants, but in fact employs another 9 million active-duty military, postal workers, contractors, and grantees. The workforce of more than 11 million is about to lose as many as 800 executives among the more than 4,100 presidential appointments that need to be filled as soon as possible. In 2008, the incoming Obama administration enjoyed the full cooperation of the outgoing Bush presidency, as well as control of both sides of Congress. It took Barack Obama 1 month to fill half of the 60 priority positions that require Senate confirmation, but it took another year to fill the other half of the posts. The pace is already unimaginable given Donald Trump's obstruction of the transition and the promise by some Republican senators to block Joe Biden's nominees. Since the Bush-Obama handover, Congress has passed two laws to improve the 1963 law that governs presidential transitions, in each case to start the massive switch in management earlier than the election. The most recent update in 2015, led by Ted Kaufman, Joe Biden's former chief of staff who now runs the Biden transition, pushed the start of the handover to 6 months before the election. In practice, campaigns are reluctant to begin the detailed work of planning for power because they fear that it will look like they are arrogantly assuming victory and taking the voters for granted. Max Steyer, president and chief executive officer of Partnership for Public Service, a nonpartisan government reform group, says Donald Trump has exposed new flaws in an already flawed system. "This is a massive undertaking in an ordinary time. It is an extraordinarily hard task, and this makes it much harder," Steyer says. "What's been exposed here is a real problem and a challenge of the existing system. I think a lot of people have been appalled that cooperation isn't occurring, and I do think that there needs to be a specific legislative fix to ensure that the ascertainment decision is made with much more dispatch. Delays in transitions can lead to serious national security challenges. The 9/11 Commission found that the delayed transition followed the extended recount of the 2000 election prevented the incoming Bush administration from being fully prepared for the threat to the American security. The risks are those right in front of our faces: the need to respond to the pandemic and the economic crisis and racial equality issues," says Max Steyer. "And then there's what Rumsfeld called the known unknowns. We live in an uncertain world, and there are curveballs thrown at the country. We need to have a government that is ready for that as soon as they are in charge." In the last Democratic transition, speed was critical. Melody Barnes was part of the Obama transition in 2008 before leading the White House Domestic Policy Council. "We probably had people going into departments and agencies within 2 or 3 days of the election," Melody Barnes says. "As I remember it, there was election day, and the very next day, by noon, I had to be in meetings that would allow for the kickoff process that would allow teams to go in. When you walk in the door, you have to hit the ground running. In the early days, agency review teams seek critical information about policy, personnel, litigation and new regulations. That intelligence is relayed back to transition headquarters and may influence the new appointments under consideration. When you walk in the door and you are the Biden administration versus the Trump administration, you're still also the government of the United States," says Barnes. "And the government is in court a lot, in a lot of different places, And this regulation that was started in September, October, November, and it's moving through the process that continues in January and February. You've got to know what's going on and where it stands. For the Obama team, that included seeking the advice of career officials at the White House Office of Management and Budget to help shape the urgent need for stimulus spending after the financial crisis of 2008. Today, the Biden team, that advice would focus on both stimulus spending and vaccine distribution. However, even when the transition begins in fall, the early Republican roadblock suggests a long and fraught path to confirmation for Joe Biden's nominees. You have Lindsey Graham saying that Georgia election wasn't legitimate and ballots needed to be thrown out, says Melanie Barnes. He's also holding the hearings in the Senate, potentially managing the confirmation hearing for the Attorney General. Janet Napolitano talks about Inauguration Day in 2008 and sitting in the view stand with the other nominees. They were getting tapped on the shoulder as they were getting confirmed by the Senate. You know, there won't be a lot of shoulder tapping happening this time. That points to the far bigger problem with American political appointments, the spoil system that last underwent reform in 1883 after James Garfield was assassinated by a disgruntled and deranged supporter who believed he was owed a high-profile job. The alternative, a larger civil service, would lead to less political patronage and more policy professionalism. But at a time when Trump supporters claim they are opposed to something called the deep state, it may be hard to win broad backing for reforms. My hope is that you see more senior career leaders like Tony Fauci responsible for things and fewer political appointees who are chosen on the basis of their political affiliation, says Max Steyer. There's a big distance between where the US stands and pretty much any other democracy. The spoil system in the US isn't represented at the scale it is in Britain or any other major democracy.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense. A new model for the presence of the people in the arena of Sacred Defense and the cultivation of talents.
We could cite a youth who worked as a journalist in a certain newspaper and who later on would join the front lines, turning into a personality like Shahid Hassan Bakhri. The same is true of Shahid Babai and others. This innovative model of popular presence could always be employed. Today, too, we can benefit from this model. If we show determination and look at the people and at our affairs with the right outlook, we could benefit from this paradigm. Of course, war conditions and the economy are different from each other. Thinkers and intellectuals can consider and pursue this model as a means of national power. Should they do so, then the role of the back of forces will become as significant as the front lines in this model. This is because not everyone can hold a gun. Interests, dispositions, and capabilities are different. Some people can play as they did play their part behind the front lines. Firstly, we should mention that financial assistance and transfer of food was very important and influential.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
The same is true of attending to the wounded and the glorious act of seeing off funeral the martyrs. I have said many times that if martyrs had not received such honor and respect, the thrill of martyrdom would not have blazed the way it did. Whenever the bodies of martyrs, one or more, entered a city, the people's presence and warm reception and their act of seeing them off to their resting place was a very important and influential event. Presenting cultural and promotional activities, composing poetry and slogans, nullifying the enemy's psychological warfare, as the enemy was constantly engaged in psychological warfare, and some people in the cities and villages of the country were constantly nullifying them, hosting and accommodating war-stricken people and the people's decision to stay in their cities. For example, cities like this Phul, while their cities were under heavy bombardment, was really astonishing.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
A In what may be one of the biggest recalls in the automotive world, General Motors has announced it is calling in as many as 7 million vehicles across the globe to check potential problems with Takata airbags installed, replacing them if required. A large number of these vehicles are expected to be in the US alone. The announcement from General Motors came on Monday, 23rd of November, after the US government informed it that it had to recall around 6 million vehicles in the country to check for the potential fault with the airbag inflators. The carmaker stated that it believes the vehicles are safe, but it chose not to fight back against the decision and instead issued recall orders. It is estimated that the cost of the recall could be a massive $1.2 billion. General Motors has previously been accused by car owners of putting its profits over safety of buyers. As a result, the U.S. National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, has been keeping a close eye on the company. We now present you an article written by staff writers of the Associated Press. Under the heading, GM to recall 7 million vehicles globally to replace Takata airbags. Please stay with us for more of the Associated Press article. General Motors will recall about 7 million big pickup trucks and sport utility vehicles, SUVs, worldwide to replace potentially dangerous Takata airbag inflators. The announcement came on Monday, 23rd of November, after the US government told the automaker it had to recall 6 million of the vehicles in the United States. General Motors says it will not fight the decision, even though it believes the vehicles are safe. It will cost the company an estimated $1.2 billion, about one-third of its net income so far this year. The automaker had petitioned the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, four times since 2016 to avoid recalls, contending the airbag inflator canisters have been safe on the road and in testing. But the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration on Monday denied the petitions, saying the inflators will run the risk of exploding. Owners complained to the NHTSA that the company was placing profits before safety. Exploding Takata inflators caused the largest series of auto recalls in U.S. history, with at least 63 million inflators recalled. The U.S. government says that as of September, more than 11.1 million had not been fixed. About 100 million inflators have been recalled worldwide. Takata used volatile ammonium nitrate to create a small explosion to fill airbags in a crash, but the chemical can deteriorate when exposed to heat and humidity, and they can explode with too much pressure, blowing apart a metal canister and spewing shrapnel. 27 people have been killed worldwide by the exploding inflators, including 18 individuals in the United States. The recent decision by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, is a major step in drawing the Takata saga to a close. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says it means that all Takata ammonium nitrate inflators in the United States will be recalled. Earlier this year, the agency decided against the recall of inflators with a moisture-absorbing chemical called a desiccant. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration said it would monitor those inflators and take action if problems arise. General Motors will recall full-size pickup trucks and sport utility vehicles, SUVs, from the 2007 through to 2014 model years, including the Chevrolet Silverado 1500. 2,500 and 3,500 pickup trucks. The Silverado is General Motors' top-selling vehicle and the second best-selling vehicle in the United States. Also covered are the Chevrolet Suburban, Tahoe and Avalanche, the Cadillac Escalade, GMC Sierra 1500, 2500 and 3500, and the GMC Yukon. It took the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration more than 4 years to arrive at its decision, which comes towards the end of President Donald Trump's four-year term in office. The National Highway Transportation Safety Administration said in a prepared statement that it analyzed all available data on the airbags, including engineering and statistical analysis, aging tests, and field data. The agency said, based on this information and information provided to the petition's public docket, the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration concluded that the General Motors inflators in question are at risk of the same type of explosion after long-term exposure to high heat and humidity as others recalled Takata inflators. The statement said the company has 30 days to give the NHTSA a proposed schedule for notifying vehicle owners and starting the recall. General Motors said, although it believes the recall isn't warranted, based on the factual and scientific records, it will abide by the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration's decision. Spokesman Dan Flores said recently that none of the inflators have blown apart in the field or in laboratory testing, but he said General Motors wants to avoid a drawn-out fight with the government. In a 2019 petition to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, General Motors said the inflators were designed to its specifications and are safe, with no explosions, even though nearly 67,000 airbags have been deployed in the field. It said the inflators have larger vents and steel end caps to make them stronger. But Takata declared the General Motors front passenger inflators defective under a 2015 agreement with the government. In its petition, General Motors said that Northrop Grumman tested 4,270 inflators by artificially exposing them to added humidity and temperature cycling, and there were no explosions or abnormal deployments. However, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration hired airbag chemical expert Harold Blomquist, who told 25 airbag patents to review the data, and he concluded that the General Motors airbags were similar to other Takata inflators that had exploded in the past. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration said in documents test results for the GM inflators included abnormally high pressure events, indicative of potential future rupture risks. The agency wrote, "These findings illustrate that General Motors inflators have a similar, if not identical, degradation continuum to other Takata inflators that have exploded in the past." Dan Flores said General Motors already has purchased 1.6 million replacement inflators made by ZFTRW that do not use ammonium nitrate. Jason Levine, executive director of the Nonprofit Center for Auto Safety, which opposed General Motors' petitions to avoid recalls, said it's a good day for millions of General Motors owners who had to wait 4 years for a decision on whether they are driving with an unexploded hand grenade in their steering wheel. Shares of General Motors rose nearly 3% on Monday, trading at $44.21 a share. The company said the recall will be phased in based on replacement inflator availability and will cost $400 million this year. The previous Takata recalls drove the Japanese company into bankruptcy and brought criminal charges against the company. Eventually, it was purchased by a Chinese-owned auto parts supplier. We'll be right back.
The Debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Iran has condemned the terrorist attack against its top nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, and says his killing will not go unanswered. This week, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo had flown to Saudi Arabia to see strongman Mohammed bin Salman, and during the previous week had visited Israel. Tehran says Tel Aviv is behind the assassination. Stay with us as we look at the possible players in this terrorist attack.
The assassination of Iran's top nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh has caused outrage in the country, with officials blaming Israel for the terrorist attacks and pledging retaliation. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani called Fakhrizadeh's assassination a proof of enemies' desperation.
This terrorist act indicates the enemy's failures in political fronts in the region as well as across the world. The assassination of the scientist suggests the extent of enemy's malice and garage toward Iran's scientific capabilities and achievements. The killing of figures like Fakhrizadeh will not weaken Iran's will to move toward scientific development and progress. Rather, it makes Iranians more resolute in their path.
Chief of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, said harsh revenge awaits the terrorist elements and all those behind the assassination. Chief of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Major General Hossein Salami, said retaliation and harsh punishment for the perpetrators are already on the agenda. Salami said the terrorist act was plotted and directed by the Israeli regime. In a tweet, Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said there were serious indications of an Israeli role in the assassination. Fakhrizadeh's name was mentioned multiple times in a 2018 presentation by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, where he repeated Tel Aviv's baseless allegations against Tehran's nuclear program.
A key part of the plan was to form new organizations to continue the work. This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
The New York Times also quoted three intelligence officials as saying that Israel was behind the terrorist attack. Hossein Dehghan, a military advisor to the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, said Israel is seeking to intensify pressure on Iran with the aim of provoking a full-fledged war. The former defense minister said Iran will descend like lightning on the killers of the country's scientists and will make them regret their actions. The head of the Iranian judiciary's High Council for Human Rights said Fakhrizadeh's assassination was aimed at hindering the country's scientific progress.
What is noteworthy from my point of view about the assassination attempt made today in Tehran was that there is a serious will by the Iranians' enemy to prevent the improvement and advancement of the Iranian people. They are going to put hurdles on our way.
Fakhrizadeh was also leading a team tasked with developing one of Iran's first kits for coronavirus diagnosis. The plot to assassinate him was not the first, as he had survived several such attempts in the past years. Four other Iranian nuclear scientists were assassinated between 2010 and 2012, with Tehran and Western intelligence agencies blaming Israel for those killings. The Israeli terror campaign has been widely seen as a project to stymie Iran's peaceful nuclear activities, which have been under the intense scrutiny of the International Atomic Energy Agency.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program, journalist and commentator Leif Maruf, out of Beirut, and peace and justice activist and analyst Sarbaz Ruhollah Rezvi, out of Qom. Thank you both for being with us. Let's start this off in Beirut. Leif, who do you think is actually responsible for this terrorist attack?
Well, we don't have definite proof, but we have fingerprints of those who did it, and we know that the apartheid Israel has been targeting the nuclear program of Iran for more than a decade now. We have heard the comments of the Prime Minister of Apartheid Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, a couple of years ago, specifically naming Professor Fakhrizadeh as one of the targets that they are going after. And we have seen that the collaboration between Apartheid Israel and Mujahideen Khalq that are stationed in France and Albania and have been receiving huge amounts of support by the United States and European powers along with Apartheid Israel. So all of these are the main culprits that are suspects for this dreadful assassination. And we can add on top of them Saudi-occupied Arabia and the meeting that happened between MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, and Netanyahu and Pompeo just days before this assassination.
Sayyid Ruhollah, during the almost 42 years since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, we've seen many actions against the country. Terrorist attacks against nuclear scientists are just one of those actions. Why do you think that this is the case? What's the bottom line? What are Iran's enemies after by doing these type of acts?
Referring back to your first question, I think analytically it's very clear that who is behind all these acts of terrorism in Iran. Looking again back to the series of terror attacks between 2010 and 2012, in which four prominent Iranian scientists were assassinated, this, after, of course, a gap of 8 years, is another act of terror analytically proven done by the Zionists, not based on the data, but based on the analysis. It's quite clear, and all the analysts across the globe will confess that the only regime that can benefit from these sorts of acts against Iranian scientists is the Zionist regime. So it's very clear. But there is one important point that, because someone said, okay, there's something between Iran and Israel, and that's why Israel is making targeting Iranian scientists. But let's go to the roots of the problem between Iran and Israel. Iran, initially speaking, particularly from the perspective of country, particularly from the perspective of a nation state, it has nothing to do with Israel. No borders there, nothing is related to Iran and Israel. But there's just only one point, which is from the perspective of the Iranian revolution. That is the issue of occupied Palestine and Jerusalem and the refugees in the case of Palestine. So going to the core of this conflict between Iran and Israel is something related to the issue of Palestine. Because I see so many commentators, so many observers are ignoring this part of the story. This is all because of Palestine. What Iran is paying now, the price that Iran is paying now, exactly the time that the Arab regimes are looking after normalization of their ties and making benefit of their connection with the Zionists as well as the Americans, based on the connection, based on the normalization of ties with Zionists. They are looking after their profits and benefits, but at the same time, Iran is paying the price of defending the issue of Palestine. Unless, if you look at it, as I mentioned at the very beginning, from the perspective of a nation state as Iran, and if you forget about the Iranian revolution, there's nothing between Iran and Israel. There were relations between Iran and Israel before that. Look at the 70s, look at 60s. Iran was on the side of the Israelis during the Arab-Israeli war, during the Shah time. But it was the revolution, 1979 revolution, that started a new trend between Iran and Israel, and Iran decided against it.
All right. Iran has experienced 40 years of sanctions, the luring of its academics to the U.S. and other Western countries, and even its scientists imprisoned in the U.S. after they insisted that their research be recorded as being done by an Iranian science instead of as an American. Why is there such sensitivity by some Western and regional entities about Iran's academic achievements?
Well, because Iran and the rest of the world are supposed to be just servants for Western imperialism. Any state that attempts to be independent, sovereign in its academic, in its technological, in its military abilities, it is a target for the West. And this is what has been the most important achievement of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, that it was able to turn Iran under all these extreme pressures of wars, of sanctions, and blockades of the country, to turn it into a powerhouse of education, of technology, of science, and to be sovereign in those choices and be able to achieve and deliver on its basic needs of technology, of electricity, of energy, of defense. And, you know, we have to keep in mind here today this assassination of this great scientist. It does not come out of the blue. It, as mentioned before, there was assassinations in 2010 and 2012 of Iranian nuclear scientists, and those assassinations happened under the regime of Obama. So right now we have a change happening in the United States. Some people are wishing or wishful thinking that Biden is going to change anything. But remember, it was Obama who started this practice of assassinating scientists in Iran. Trump is just continuing it, and definitely Biden will also.
Well, Laith, you brought up an interesting topic that I want to get into a little bit later, but now that you've brought it up, you talked about that basically it doesn't matter if it's a Democrat or a Republican in the White House. Their policy in dealing with Iran, one, and dealing with Israel is basically the same. I want to look at that side of things. And Sarwaz Ruhollah, you alluded a little bit earlier that the bottom line of all of this is Iran stands in dealing with Palestine. Put all of this together, and how do you see this overall sensitivity that Washington has for Tel Aviv and what seems to be this disdain for the Islamic Republic of Iran?
You know the problem. You know, there are different, you know, issues, different cases between Iran and the United States of America from the very beginning of the Iranian Revolution. But there is one very crystal clear issue between Iran and America. That is Palestine. Iran is definite in supporting and standing with the Palestinians and to liberate the Palestinian occupied lands. And the United States of America also, be them Democrats or Republicans, no difference, are very clear to be in support of the Zionist regime. This is the red line for both. I mean, the red line for Iran is Palestine, the red line for the American regime and the United States of America, whoever is going to rule the country, it doesn't make any difference, is to support the security of as they say, so-called security of the Zionist regime. So that is the clash point, actually, between Iran and the United States of America. And as it was mentioned, Joe Biden also very clear in defending the so-called security of Israel and having no tolerance against so-called, you know, resistant, what they call it, the terrorist groups, and also from our perspective, the resistant groups. So this is that bottom line. And don't forget, there is a theory of a trap. Regarding this assassination taking place, some believe that it is a trap because Biden is coming, most possibly, and if Iran is going to react, the consequences could be very, very bad for Iran. That's why it is a trap for Iran and to trigger Iran, to stimulate Iran, that Iran will come and react. But I believe that this analysis, this theory of trap analysis for what took place in the assassination is totally, you know, baseless. I don't believe in that. Because the first issue is that the one who is behind the assassinations is Zionist regime itself. It's not a matter of the assassination. It's not a matter of the martyrdom of the General Soleimani, which was done directly by the Americans. This act of terror was done, we believe, analytically, was done directly by the operation of Mossad, as it was done before. So this is the first point. So if Iran is going to react, the target of Iran possibly is Israel.
Well, let me just jump in here. Sarwaz Ruhollah, you said it was Mossad. Do you think that the United States was also involved, or do you think that they had previous information about this attack?
I have no comment on that. But the point is that the Zionist regime has always mentioned that they are looking after their targets inside Iran. And if they find any opportunity, I don't believe that they are going to postpone their, act of their evil act of terror inside Iran. So the recent case, they have been looking at, as was mentioned by Netanyahu 2 years ago in 2018, that Fakhrizadeh, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, was the target from years before. And he was assassinated. There were different attempts of assassinations as well. I believe that Zionists, if they find their targets, if they find any possibility of targeting any scientist, anyone who is a prominent person in the progress, in the scientific progress of Iran, they will not lose their opportunity and
okay.
they will do I have looked on the information, the possible information of the American side or not, but I'm sure that whenever they find the opportunity, they will do their evil job.
All right, well, Lyth, what about that? Do you think that the terrorist attacks, like the one yesterday, is actually a sign of weakness of a regime initiating the attack, and that it's a desperate attempt to try to create chaos and disruption in Iran's progress?
Definitely. You could see in the last few years how the apartheid Israel and the United States itself have realized that their power is waning, and they are not able to achieve much with all the tools that they have used before. They're also not able to go into a direct war with even somebody as small as Hezbollah in Lebanon with around 30, 40,000 fighters. So what has happened in the last year with the assassination of Martyr General Soleimani and al-Muhandis, and now the assassination of Fakhrizadeh, is them trying to show that they have an ability somehow to harm the progress of Iran and the resistance axis in general. One thing that we have to point out here is that, whether Biden comes into power in January or not, there will be no change in the process of how the United States views Iran. My colleague spoke about the red line of apartheid Israel. It is because apartheid Israel is the only thing that guarantees the supremacy of the United States in the Western Asia and North Africa region. Without that existing, naturally all the Arab people will unify no matter what stands in their way other mm-hmm. than apartheid Israel. So what we have here is an existential issue. Palestine and the liberation of Palestine are existential for us as Arabs, as Muslims in the region, and it's also an existential issue for white supremacy and imperialism in a global scale, not only in control of our region. And things are coming into a head there. And we know that even those who give up on Palestine or give up their weapons, let's say like Gaddafi and the regimes in Egypt and others, they don't get anything in return. In fact, they get killed as Gaddafi got killed. So Iran, Syria, Hezbollah, Yemen, they have learned the lesson that you have to stand on your principles and you have to fight back, because even if you give in to the empire doesn't want you to be an equal.
Okay, well, Sarbaz Ruhollah, now some Western countries are calling for restraint. What does that exactly mean when they're asking Tehran to restrain itself after such a terrorist attack, and when at the same time Tehran can definitely expect nothing from the so-called international community as far as actually doing something against the perpetrators?
Yes, as I mentioned, it's based on an illusion that they think that if Iran is not going to react on what place, and there are opportunities for JCPOA being once again on the track after the new government in the United States of America. But as it was mentioned, there is no any fundamental and substantial difference between what's going on in between Iran and the United States of America by the changes of the governments inside the United States of America. But I believe there is one important point that should be followed. Sorry to to shift a little bit because I want to mention this important point. I believe that there should be a legal reaction on behalf of the Iranian side, because let's not forget that Shahid Fakhrizadeh, Dr. Fakhrizadeh was the deputy of the Iranian Defense Minister. He was a high-level Iranian authority in the Iranian guard, the deputy of the Iranian Defense Minister, assassinated by Zionist regime behind him. So there should be a legal process to raise this case in the legal, platforms of world, because this has been repeated once again and again.
A legal process, where exactly are you talking about?
It should be followed on behalf of the Iranian side. Any possible international court, international, international platform, where this case of terror should, because this is against all the charters and the basis of the United Nations and all the international law. All these laws have been, violated by the Zionist regime.
Okay, stay with me. I'm almost out of time. I want to get Leith back in on this. Leith, your take on that. Do you think that this can be followed up by the international community or in a legal setting, that Iran actually would be able to proceed and actually get the verdict that they deserve? Or is it something that Iran really has to pursue in a different way to get that revenge or justice, if you want to say?
Well, they have to remember that the International Court of Justice and other international courts, both apartheid Israel and the United States, are not part of those jurisdictions, and they have refused to be part of that. So what does this mean? That means that Iran really cannot pursue that war. And we have to remember also that these international courts are marred with racism and colonialism and have always only targeted countries in Africa and Asia, and never have pursued the war criminals of the United States and others. And we know how the judges in the International Court of Justice are now under sanctions by the United States.
Okay. I'm going to have to cut both of you off. Sorry, Basru Hala. I know you want to get in this, but we're out of time. And thank you both, journalist and commentator Leith Maruf out of Beirut, and peace and justice activist and analyst Sarbaz Ruhollah Rezvi out of Qom. And as always,